My name is Nandi, as earlier was said, Vanqa Mgijima. I work for the International Labour Research and Information Group, an NGO that was once associated to the UCT Sociology Department. For political reasons, UCT decided to part ways with it, and we are on our own, and we are based in Salt River, the centerpiece of the apartheid struggles at Community House, Salt River Road. So what we do, our work is actually focusing on looking at alternatives to globalization. We've got different programs. As she has mentioned, I work on a program called Building Women's Activism, looking for alternatives also, and looking at how globalization impacts women differently. And there's a program called Trade and Investment. We are not doing investment, but we are looking at how trade and investment impacts also the working class, and how is it being done from the north with the south of south countries. The economic policies that have always been proposed by the north powerful countries. And how are these relations mutual, and what are the alternatives? Looking at examples in Venezuela, the Alba banks, how they operate. And also the third program is Youth and Globalization, which I think it might also interest you. It's also looking at how globalization impacts young people. They talk a lot about the nights, the McDonald's, the cell phone technology today, and how that impacts or influences the lives of young people. The fourth program is Public Democracy and Public Power, mainly focusing on issues of service delivery by local government. What policies inform the local government's operation? Are these policies really meant to meet the needs of the poor? But from budgetary allocations to local government municipalities, you have seen, and I think recently also the uprising, so the service delivery protests. So those are the issues that this program looks at. And then we've got a program called New Forms of Organization. It merely looks at how are trade unions adopting to organize workers in this period of globalization, whereby forms of work have changed. As the other is saying, that the supercare workers are also mainly women who are not employed on permanent basis. They are employed on short-term casualization and all those sorts of new forms of employment. And it also looks at trade unions, how trade unions take care of women's issues and prioritize them. Those are the five programs that we have at ILRIC. I've been asked to come and share with you this kind of work that you are doing. I've prepared a presentation and with two main case studies that we will actually focus on women in the agricultural sector, how trade liberalization has affected the lives of those women, and also the rise of domestic labor in South Africa after 1994. I think one thing that before I start with my presentation that I want to pose to you, two questions which you can keep in mind and probably later you can share with the group as to your responses. What kind of a system do we live in today in South Africa after 1994? Or what is the nature of the post-apartheid South Africa? And the second one is, where are women positioned within this system? So you'll talk about all different classes of women. Where are they positioned today? My presentation is going to be, as I say, is going to be looking at the lives of ordinary women, and also in relation to the policies that have been adopted by the South African government, the ANC-led government, since 1994. But I will quickly want to say, before, there have been views that have claimed that women have always been oppressed and that inequality has always lived with them, or with us as women. One of the big writers or politicians, Engels, argues that during early years of ERA, human history, the sexual division of labor within the system of economic production was complementary as opposed to hierarchical. So sexual division of labor under capitalism is different from previous societies. So the development of capitalism and the industrial revolution created a physical separation between productive in your farms, in your working place, and reproductive work in your homes. So hence Engels locates oppression of women primarily from their reproductive role within the family and the family's role as an economic unit in society. It is therefore an integral part of the reproduction of the capitalist relations. Under capitalist system, women are usually exploited and face triple oppression at home, at work, and in their communities. every day of their lives. And women continue to suffer setbacks in many ways due to the developmental rhetoric and policies adopted at the behest of the international financial institutions that are influences countries' policies, your World Bank, your IMF, International Monetary Fund. And this is because the need of ordinary working class women are often ignored in gender equality interventions, also in those policies or loan conditions that are as a result of the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO. You'll find that women's issues are ignored also from those policy prescripts. So although qualitative efforts have been made in South Africa to address the position of women and elsewhere through policy changes, political representation, especially in South Africa, and economic freedom, but still the majority of South Africa's working class women are still largely trapped in poverty and high levels of unemployment. So we say South Africa's macroeconomic policy adopted in 1996 meant the defeat and the betrayal of the working class by the ruling class. And you remember that the ruling class, before it came into power, the African National Congress had a document called the Freedom Charter, where you have all those clauses saying that those who live or who work the land shall share, shall have the land. We shall have free education. And I think as we are seated there, this education that you are receiving is not free. So this is the defeat and the betrayal that I'm talking about as a result of the market-led policies that they have adopted. So what is the economic transformation and the position of women in South Africa after 1994? The government committed to reconstruct the South African society and redistribute state resources through its Reconstruction and Development Program. You remember the RDP. That was the program spearheaded by Jay Naidu. So the first priority of this policy was to meet the basic needs of people: jobs, land, housing, water, and electricity. And you will recall, or if you are not aware, the reason for this is that the majority of South Africans who are African, black, were the ones who were adversely affected by policies of apartheid, which were discriminatory. So they were not active in the macroeconomic system of the apartheid system. So this policy wanted to close that gap or to address those challenges. But some of the critics or the analysts of these policies, Patrick Bond, says that the RDP was fatally undermined by nervous politicians, hostile state officials, and unreliable private sector partners. And Naidu, the RDP minister, did not really command the respect of his ANC parliamentary colleagues and did not always see eye to eye with President Mandela on RDP. So I just want to say to you also, Mandela was also behind, also not necessarily in favor of the RDP, but he was also, in a later policy, also agreed to implement it after the RDP. So the invitation of the RDP by Naidu had to cater too much to the satisfaction of the capitalist interests. Remember the RDP, we said it wanted to look at job creation, the entire social network for the disadvantaged. But it ended up also being a program that wanted to also serve the interests, the pressure that was put by the capitalists also, and also those ANC people. In 1996, the then Minister Trevor Emmanuel released South Africa's post-apartheid macroeconomic policy gear without any consultation with this party. So it was Trevor, Mandela, Mbeki, without any consultation with the tripartite alliance around policy issues, and then RDP was dumped in introduction of gear. So this policy was prepared, and you listen carefully to this. This policy was prepared by 13 consultants, all of whom were men, with only one black. They came from business, government, and two came from the World Bank in Washington, D.C. So the SACP, COSATU, were never part of this group, as they are a tripartite alliance of the ruling party. There were two main ideas behind GEAR. They said South Africa needed to engage more fully with the global economy. Secondly, that the state wanted to focus more on assisting business to increase its profits. So this meant speeding up of privatization to encourage foreign investment, to bring down inflation, cut the national deficit, and they had hoped that this would reduce poverty. So what are the components of GEAR? It is trade liberalization. I think Yaliwe just spoke about it, which means free trade by removing any restriction on foreign trade. So e.g. taxes on foreign companies, on goods that were coming into South Africa to be eliminated. And probably that is why we saw a proliferation of the Chinese markets in South Africa, even those that were legally coming and illegally coming, but that was what we saw. And it meant the closure of the textile, clothing and textile industry. Especially it affected the clothing and textile industry, which is based in your main road up to Salt River, Woodstock, where it used to employ the majority of black working class women. So this trade liberalization impacted on that. The other component of GEAR, according to these people that drafted it, it said that we should regulate flexibility of labor markets, meaning that substantial flexibility should be introduced, resulting in downward variations in employment standards and less protection for the unemployed and moderation of wages. And I think Isupake is one example of that. Woolworths is also one example of that. Employment patterns have changed. We have seen wage stagnation. And the sectors that I'm talking about, women are the majority. The other component is the removal of exchange controls. According to them, it will attract foreign investment into the country. And this meant that the capitalists will be able to take money in and out. So they invest in South Africa, they take their money. They are not South Africans, they invest in South Africa. South Africans who has sold their labor, they do not benefit. They take, these capitalists take their money and invest it elsewhere or where they come from, mostly in Europe and Asian countries. The other component is tight monetary policy. GEAR supported high interest rates, as we always hear, to keep inflation, thus discouraging increases in credit availability. And for the working class, how does this impact them? You've got also probably co-ops, women's organizations that want to do their own business as cooperatives, and they do not have a base to start this, so it prevents them from accessing loans from the bank. The other component is productivity improvements. GEAR argued that the amount of work produced by each worker must increase, but also arguing that wages should not increase faster than productivity. That is mere slavery, that people are expected to work harder for paltry salaries. Although policies of trade liberalization have had already been adopted in the 1980s by the apartheid government, the ANC-led government had vigorously embraced this market-led economic policy. In the 80s, the apartheid government started partially commercializing Eskom and other state-owned enterprises. So when ANC came into power, and without even being forced as the other African countries, as they were forced by the IMF as a result of the loan conditions, South Africa voluntarily adopted these market-led policies. The ANC government. The government's agenda with this program was to refrain from economic intervention and concentrate on the necessary adjustments that would create an optimal climate for private investment. And you will hear why they were doing this. The negative impact of GEAR on women and social reproduction has become worse due to privatization. And we will point four main negative effects of this. The increasing costs on women, because when services or functions, when they are privatized, prices paid by citizens tend to rise. An example is that of water or electricity are run by a private company. Charges are usually increased in order to generate profits. Private companies are there to generate profits, and they are not there for the social well-being of its citizens as to government. The other negative effect is loss of accountability, because when a private person is providing a service, that person is not accountable to its citizens, but the government is accountable to its citizens. We elect them, we pay taxes, the revenue is as a result of the taxes that we pay. So when services are provided by the council or by another sphere of government, providers are directly accountable to the public. For instance, if your streets are not cleaned, you have a right to complain to a council through your elected councillor. But when a private company cleans your streets, we have no direct ways to pressure that company. And I think we have seen in many areas that where service delivery is no longer the same as before. Streets maybe are cleaned once a week, and the communities in those areas are just silent. They are just accepting what is happening because they do not know who is the middleman, because it's no longer your local government that is directly providing this service. There's a middleman that is this private person that I'm talking about. So the government, that accountability, the government is removing irresponsibility of care, of taking care of its citizens. The other negative effects are the tighter financial controls. When the private sector or corporatized government departments like Eskom, like Rand Water Board provides a service, they tend to impose harsh regulations about payments. If you don't pay, you lose access to the service. Often privatization means the use of cost recovery measures like prepaid meters, which force people to pay before they use their services. Today, the reason why you have the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee was a result of these measures. People were served with red letters, disconnected, and the reaction or the response from the working class was to also go and disconnect. You remember, if you remember, Amos Masondo of Johannesburg, where the Igoli 20 whatever Igoli, and this was a project of privatization in Gauteng. So the response from the people was to go and disconnect. They were also disconnected, served with red letters, and these are the people that are not working or are working but earning paltry salaries. And because there's a private person who wants to profit, so prices have skyrocketed. Government as far has removed itself from provision of these services. And I think the worst negative effect is the job losses that we have seen after 1994. When a service is privatized, the first step taken by the new operators is usually to look for ways to cut costs. The first target would be your workers. Privatization has often led to retrenchment, casualization, wage reduction in benefits, or pressure workers to work harder for the same money. So when the UCT decided to go the outsourcing route, many workers lost employment and benefits that were afforded directly by the University of Cape Town. Because if you were a worker, a cleaner at UCT, employed directly by UCT, some of the benefits were that your children would also be benefiting from the education that is provided here. And there are some children, I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the economists in Lejana was also one of the beneficiaries of such benefits provided by the employer directly. But then UCT, I think during the time of Ramphele, decided to go the way of privatizing, outsourcing, not directly having a link or irresponsibility of providing, because that's the main thing of providing protection benefits for its workers, the social welfare of the workers. It decided to say, Yaliwe, take this part of cleaning section, security, gardening, and all these services that you see at UCT. Those workers used to be employed directly by UCT. They used to benefit from UCT, medical aid, you name them. But today, those workers are employed in precarious forms of employment. At times, they are working short time, no benefits, even those that are basic in terms of the basic conditions of Employment Act. And these are the results of GIA with its elements, like job losses, tighter financial controls. If people want to ask questions as we go through, welcome to do so. Okay, sis.